From Maine Public Radio and MainePublic.org, I'm Jennifer Mitchell with the news on this day in Maine, Wednesday, March 11th, 2020. Maine state health officials say there are still no confirmed cases of COVID-19 in Maine, the disease caused by the new coronavirus. But meanwhile, they're working to prepare Maine healthcare providers for any cases that might arise. Mal Leary has more.
Dr. Nirav Shah, director of the state's Centers for Disease Control, says the CDC has been meeting with various groups of healthcare providers to update them on best practices. He says he is concerned about reports from Italy of doctors and other providers getting overwhelmed by the high number of cases.
It does no one any good if the healthcare force, whether that be physicians, nurses, ambulance drivers, everyone who's in the healthcare community, it does us no good if they then burn themselves out.
Shaw says the CDC is also teaming up with a statewide 211 information line to provide operators to answer basic questions about the coronavirus and to direct callers to where they can get answers to more complex questions. For Maine Public Radio News, I'm Mal Leary.
Governor Janet Mills is launching an effort to test whether the mid-coast town of Searsport has potential as a hub for the development of wind energy off the Maine coast. Mills says Maine can be a leader in U.S. efforts to design and build floating wind platforms suitable for deep coastal waters.
The offshore wind industry is set to become a $1 trillion industry by 2040. And Maine and the East Coast in particular are ideal for starting an offshore wind facility. And we're very excited about that. And we're talking to the fishing industry as well and making sure that they're a big part of decision making.
Mills is directing the State Department of Transportation and other agencies to assess the Deepwater MacPort Terminal's capabilities and needs. The facility is already a delivery point for land-based wind turbines, and now the UMaine-led consortium Aquaventus is planning to build the hull for an experimental floating wind platform there. Mills says the project could eventually create more than $112 million in economic activity and more than 550 construction jobs.
This Day in Maine is made possible by the Dempsey Center, making life better for people managing the impact of cancer. Locations in Lewiston and South Portland. DempseyCenter.org.
Well, there's still no reported cases of the new coronavirus in Maine, but both the University of Maine system and Bowdoin College announced today that students will no longer be allowed on campus after spring break in an effort to prevent the spread of COVID-19. Both plan to continue classes online for the rest of the semester. Other campuses in the state are watching the situation closely, but they're staying open for the time being. Robbie Feinberg reports.
In a letter to students and faculty on Wednesday, Bowdoin President Clayton Rose said that the college decided to prohibit students from returning to the Brunswick campus after spring break in order to protect those within the community, quote, who are most at risk from COVID-19. Scott Hood, the college's vice president for communications and public affairs, says the school realized that if some students did return to campus from spring break with the disease, Bowdoin likely would not have the ability to properly isolate large groups of people.
So rather than attempt to manage what would be the required isolation of anyone who is infected, especially with the possibility that we could be dealing with a large number of students, we've decided to complete the semester using remote learning techniques.
Later in the day, the University of Maine system made a similar announcement, saying that all on-campus residential students would need to make plans to leave their universities before spring break ends on March 22nd. Spokesperson Dan DeMeritt says that the increasing number of cases of COVID-19 in the United States, as well as the declaration of the virus as a pandemic, made the university system ultimately decide to shift to online and distance courses for the rest of the semester.
We're fortunate that we don't have any declared cases yet in Maine, but we wanted to take these steps because we knew that ultimately thousands of students would be traveling across the country and in some cases the world, and we wanted to do all we could, given our unique position as a public university, limit the exposure and spread of the disease.
DeMeritt says that dorms and dining halls will stay open for certain students who might not be able to return home, including international students and those who've aged out of foster care.
So we'll be working with those students and finding solutions for them.
Other colleges in the state say they're watching the situation very closely, but...
So our plan right now is to remain open and more or less business as usual following spring break.
James Herbert, president of the University of New England in Biddeford, says UNE has already taken several steps to reduce exposure by encouraging students to reduce travel and canceling many study abroad experiences. Herbert says school officials are continually meeting to monitor the situation as it changes, but he says that at the moment he feels confident in the university's plans for protecting student health.
I'll give you just one example. We have emptied out a dorm by moving students around so that we have a dorm that is sitting there empty and is available should we need to quarantine students in that dorm.
Lewiston's Bates College is also planning to stay open. In a letter to students and parents, President Clayton Spencer says that because Bates doesn't have a spring break before the end of the semester in mid-April, it isn't planning to suspend any in-person classes on campus. But the college says that it is prohibiting all college-sponsored non-essential travel for students and staff, as well as large group gatherings on campus. But some colleges say their plans to remain open could change quickly. At Bar Harbor's College of the Atlantic, spokesperson Rob Levin says the college is, quote, seriously considering the eventuality that it may need to move to online classes for its spring trimester while closing dorms and dining halls. Levin says officials are still meeting and will have a decision by the end of the week. For Maine Public Radio News, I'm Robbie Feinberg.
Maine Senator Angus King says as Congress does what it can to respond to the spread of the new coronavirus in the U.S., it's important for everyone to do their part to limit person-to-person transmission. King, who was a guest on Maine Calling today, told Maine Public's Keith Shortall that he doesn't believe the Trump administration reacted quickly enough to the arrival of COVID-19.
In terms of are we doing enough, probably not. I think the administration was slow off the ball here. But last week, in a matter of 48 hours, the Congress passed a very comprehensive and well-funded initiative to deal with this in terms of the health aspects, testing, working on a vaccine, assistance to medical facilities across the country. So I think that's starting to get out. I think part of it is also leading by example. Frankly, somebody told me this morning the vice president has announced he's going to keep shaking hands with people. Well, that's not right. This is a serious matter. And it can go – I think last Saturday there was one person in New Rochelle, New York, one guy, and now there are 46 people. I think that's the number in that town. This thing can explode, and it explodes through human contact. And for a politician to say no handshaking is that's hard. But that's the kind of thing that we have to do. And this is a very serious matter. As you know, the World Health Organization about an hour ago pronounced this a worldwide pandemic. So, what do we do? Personal hygiene, washing your hands, keeping your hands away from your face. Don't shake hands. And I think, we're going to see more and more large sort of collections of people not happening. There was a big dinner here in Washington on Saturday that's been canceled. And, the two Democratic candidates canceled their rallies last night in Cleveland. We're just going to have to try to mitigate this and also try to contain it at the same time.
So within the general public, there seems to be a spectrum of personal opinions or philosophies toward this, ranging from on the one end, gee, this is a serious public health emergency, to on the other end, wash your hands, live your life, this too shall pass. Is that spectrum reflected among members of Congress as well, or are you?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, last week we had a member of the House, go to the floor with a gas mask on. He was being cute, and unfortunately, one of his constituents died of the disease the next day. But let me just put this into perspective: the garden variety flu that we all know about, and we have our shots in the fall, kills between 35,000 and 45,000 people a year. It's the death rate is about 0.1%. In other words, 0.1% of the people that have that flu die. This coronavirus, the estimates range from 2% to 3.5% death rate. And 2% is 20 times the death rate for the regular flu. So this is not something that's made up. It's not something that, you know, we can sort of laugh off. It's not. It isn't the regular flu. So we really have to take it seriously. I've made some decisions. I decided. Not to go to a major dinner here in Washington, and I'm going to try to, I'm washing my hands and doing all those kinds of things. We're all elbow bumping down here.
Yeah. I mean, you've seen that Bowdoin has announced it will not let students return to campus after spring break.
I just saw that.
Yeah. So you view that as the kind of appropriate response that private institutions can take to protect?
Well, it seems a little extreme, but I think here's an anecdote. The Spanish flu in 1918, which, by the way, killed 50 million people across the world and 600,000 in America. In Philadelphia, the health commissioner refused to stop a big parade that was happening in the town and didn't take any real proactive steps. 12,000 people died. In St. Louis, the health commissioner said, you know, we're going to shut down major events. We're not going to have baseball, ball games, whatever. And 1,700 people died. So there are two sort of stories. And I guess the answer is, it's a cliche, better be safe than sorry. I'd rather be preventive and maybe go overboard a little bit on the prevention than have to suffer what our country suffered 100 years ago.
Maine Senator Angus King on today's Maine Calling. Maine lawmakers are considering a bill that would bar foreign nationals and certain foreign corporations from spending to influence ballot campaigns. It's designed to close a loophole in Maine election law, but it could also have an immediate impact on Hydro-Québec, the electricity supplier for a controversial $1 billion transmission line through western Maine. Government-owned Hydro-Québec has called the project the biggest sales contract in its entire history, and it's fighting to continue spending money to convince Maine voters not to scuttle it at the ballot box this November. Steve Missler has our story.
The proposal to prohibit foreign spending on Maine ballot campaigns is sponsored by independent state representative Kent Ackley of Monmouth. He told members of the legislature's Veterans and Legal Affairs Committee that his bill isn't just about Central Maine Power's transmission project.
Whether you are for or against the CMP corridor, every Mainer ought to be disturbed when we see a foreign company, such as Hydro-Québec, controlled completely by a foreign country, attempt to buy a Maine election.
Hydro-Québec joined the campaign last fall by forming a ballot question committee to support the project, and it's since been buying print and digital ads touting its purported environmental benefits to Maine. But the Canadian utility's involvement immediately raised questions about foreign influence in a Maine election and highlights an election law loophole first reported by Maine Public Radio that allows foreign nationals and companies controlled by foreign governments to spend on state ballot initiatives. Ackley says his bill closes that loophole.
If the shoe were on the other foot and the state of Maine was exploiting a legal loophole attempting to influence a Quebec vote, I would imagine Quebec voters would be just as outraged as the voters of Maine are today.
Ackley's bill is backed by Democratic Senate President Troy Jackson, who says it's the kind of check that's needed in the wake of the U.S. Supreme Court's Citizens United decision, which has led to an explosion in campaign spending all across the country.
Regardless of your opinions about that 2010 decision, I believe that there is widespread agreement on the need to curb unregulated campaign spending and create a more ethical campaign finance system.
And former Senate President Rick Bennett, a Republican, also supports the bill, which he says fixes a glaring deficiency in Maine election law. Bennett says while federal law clearly prohibits foreign nationals and foreign companies from contributing to candidates, it is silent on state referendum campaigns.
As foreign interests cannot contribute money to the elections of lawmakers, they ought not to be able to contribute money to the elections to make laws.
But opponents of the bill say it could have a chilling effect on free speech. Central Maine Power lobbyist Jim Mitchell says the measure would effectively silence Hydro-Québec's views on the project.
To repress information, a portion of the argument, if you will, through this bill is to disavow the central idea of our country, freedom of expression. Our very liberty depends on the protection of a free exchange of ideas. If this bill becomes law, what's next?
Central Maine Power has already sunk millions of dollars into the project, roughly $56 million according to documents with the Public Utilities Commission. And that's in addition to the $2.2 million spent just in the final quarter of last year by its Political Action Committee to defeat the referendum. Last year's campaign spending does not include the cost of new opposition research, attorneys, or the advertising that's intensified this year, nor the cost of a private investigator hired by CMP's Political Action Committee to sniff out irregularities in its opponent's referendum drive. So far, Hydro-Québec's reported spending is small by comparison, about $230,000, but it's expected to balloon if the referendum qualifies for the ballot.
This legislation would put our company at an unfair disadvantage.
François Ramsey, general counsel for Hydro-Québec, says that the company should have a right to publicly express its views about the project and any attempts to derail it.
There is no doubt that we are subject to U.S. laws when we operate in the United States. Likewise, we believe we also benefit from protections of our rights, including free speech under the U.S. Constitution.
Concerns about potential free speech violations were echoed by the bill's opponents, including the Maine State Chamber of Commerce, the Maine Forest Products Council, and the Industrial Energy Consumers Group, or IECG. IECG's lobbyist, Tony Buxton, described the bill as an emotional response that could have negative consequences for foreign investors in Maine's paper mills.
Maine has seven paper mills. Six of the seven, in all likelihood, would be prohibited by this legislation from participating in any referendum that affected them.
And attorney Timothy Woodcock, who has been hired to represent Hydro-Québec, says while the federal ban on foreign contributions to political candidates is designed to prevent corruption, that's not an issue for ballot campaigns.
No one comes out of a referendum holding office.
Representative Kent Ackley says his bill has precedent elsewhere in the country, including 11 of the 26 states with citizen initiative laws. And a similar measure in the city of Seattle was recently backed by the Democratic chairwoman of the Federal Elections Commission, Anne Lawrence Tribe, a constitutional law scholar at Harvard Law School. The Veterans and Legal Affairs Committee will review the Maine bill over the next several days. For Maine Public Radio News, I'm Steve Missler.
Well, there are currently three Republicans seeking their party's nomination to challenge incumbent Democrat Jared Golden in the 2nd District Congressional contest this November. As part of our Your Vote 2020 election coverage, Maine Public is asking each of them about the issues that pollsters have identified as being most important to Republican voters. Senior political correspondent Mal Leary spoke with Adrian Bennett, who served as press secretary to former Governor Paul LePage, about health care, the opioid crisis, and of most concern to Republicans, taxes and spending.
With a $1.4 trillion budget, there are areas of spending in which that we can dig a little deeper into and see if those are warranted, you know, necessities. As somebody who grew up in rural Maine and very poor, I understand the needs and wants issues that people have, the struggles that they have living from paycheck to paycheck. And we need to ensure that government is being held accountable for its spending. I think Congress did a fantastic job along with President Trump with the tax cuts, and that is going to give us some relief on for businesses and for individuals as well. But we need to tighten up that spending, and you need to dig into a budget. And if you remember, when I was with the governor in his administration, we did dig into the budget. And we held legislators accountable, and we marked what we thought was unwarranted spending. We had a Christmas tree go up in July because we felt the Democrats thought that they were going to get Christmas in July, everything they wanted in a budget, and we weren't going to let that happen. But you have to be able to look at a budget that is thousands of pages in many cases and identify what is unnecessary.
Some examples. What do you see as some unnecessary or less important spending that could be cut so that you can further reduce taxes?
Well, first, we have to take care of Mainers. We need to take care of our most vulnerable. We need to take care of our seniors. We've had six nursing homes close in Maine. That is unacceptable. And when we are giving general assistance or benefits or housing to people who are coming from out of state, if they are illegals or otherwise, we are not putting Mainers first. So our most vulnerable are seniors, our veterans, those with disabilities. Those are people of priority, and we need to make sure in our budget that it reflects those folks.
So you would support federal legislation that would limit that ability, because obviously it's on a state federal issue level, as well as a federal issue.
But nursing homes get federal funding as well, and that is a huge issue here in Maine. And so that's something that I'm looking forward to tackling and making sure that I'm an advocate for our most vulnerable, including our seniors.
Part of the entire nursing home problem goes to health care.
Right.
We spend huge amounts of money on health care, but we don't plan for long-term care in terms of the elderly, but we also don't do a lot of things in prevention. We still have a situation where in Medicare, there are some preventative type procedures they don't cover, mm-hmm. even though it would save money in the long run. How do you address that issue of people who say we've got to have affordable health care, but it's also got to cover this sort of stuff?
You know, we have been tackling this issue for decades, and we haven't got it right. Obamacare was a disaster, and we have a president finally who is trying to get at it from a different angle, and transparency and prices and open market, and things like that are going to help us. If we are looking for market-based solutions, if we are looking for more affordability and accessibility for people, then we need to give the power to the people in that regard. You know, we do need to make some significant changes. And it's going to take a ton of work, you know. But again, we have to dig into these issues. We need to find the solutions, identify. And I think our president is doing a good job in his first term. There's still much more work to do, of course, though. And the affordability, I hear it when I'm out visiting with people and families every single day. They don't know how they are going to pay for their insurance. And so that price transparency, I think, is a huge piece to it. And taking on the pharmaceutical companies, making sure that prescription drugs are affordable, we need to ensure this for our people.
Kind of a subset of this issue is the opioid crisis.
Yes.
Everybody knows somebody, either directly in their family or a friend, who's been hit by this crisis. What is the role of the federal government in trying to solve it?
You know, we need to have a broader conversation, and we need to give states the flexibility to tackle it on their own. And that needs to be a multi-pronged approach. Governor LePage, when I was in the administration, I worked with then Secretary of Health and Human Services Tom Price and Kellyanne Conway when they came to Maine, and we had an opioid task force roundtable. We talked about the issues that were impacting us. Since I've been on the campaign trail, I've met with 5 different sheriffs from Penobscot County, Oxford County, Hancock County, and the issue stems not only on the opioid crisis, and you know that's a huge problem we have, but also mental health, and that's an issue we need to tackle, have a broader conversation about, and be able to have the willingness to talk about depression, anxiety, PTSD amongst our veterans, and just general population. It's all intertwined, and the federal government needs to assist the states in making sure that they have the flexibility to take on this issue appropriately from a law enforcement standpoint, from a preventative and education standpoint. So they're all factors there.
Adrian Bennett, thank you very much for taking some time to talk with us.
Thank you, Mal. It's always a pleasure.
And that was Mal Leary speaking with Adrian Bennett, who served as press secretary to former Governor Paul LePage. To learn more about all of the candidates in Maine's 2nd Congressional District and in the other races this year, go to mainepublic.org/yourvote. That's mainepublic.org/yourvote. And that's today's Maine News. For more stories, visit mainepublic.org and join us tomorrow on Maine Calling at 1 o'clock, where the team examines the latest news on the new coronavirus, which is now labeled a pandemic. I'm Jennifer Mitchell.